You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2013 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. Bernie Krause can take you back 16,000 years by relating a complex sonic narrative, trees rustling for a moment like hundreds of muted castanets. You can hear animals, quote, hooting, bleating, growling, chirping, warbling, cooing, tweeting, clucking, humming, clicking, howling, screaming, peeping, sighing, shrieking, stridulating, cawing, hissing. No one makes better lists of sounds than Bernie Krause. Predators generate thundering footfalls as they crash through the vegetation after their terrified prey. And in his chapter on our prehistoric past, he introduces the importance of sound to each organism's evolution. He writes, quote, "These are the sounds of survival, reproduction, and communication, and each species has evolved so that it is heard distinctly among the others." Of course, it's not easy to hear what Bernie Krause calls the great animal orchestra these days, as habitat disappears, as jets and helicopters crowd our skies. Telephone lines hum, garbage trucks beep and clatter, and cell phones ring, and traffic sounds dull our senses. Still, I'm sure many of you can sit in your backyards at night and listen to the coyotes sing their evening song, and it's thrilling. It's a sonic glimpse of what we're all part of. The Great Animal Orchestra is a remarkable book, and it's the product of a remarkable man's dedication and creativity. In it, you will learn that the gibbons of Indonesia are sunrise singers, that beavers can weep and moan, and what the chorus of crickets can tell us about temperature. As Bernie Krause writes, "While a picture may indeed be worth a thousand words, a natural soundscape is worth a thousand pictures." And tonight, we will listen together to the manifold narratives encoded within soundscapes, and we will consider why we must pay attention to the dangers of a vast orchestra in the process of being silenced. Bernie Krause is both a musician and a naturalist. During the 50s and 60s, he devoted himself to music. He replaced Pete Seeger as the guitarist for the legendary Weavers. For more than 40 years, Krause has traveled the world recording and archiving the sounds of creatures and environments, large and small. He has recorded more than 15,000 species and 4,000 hours of wild soundscapes. He has a fascinating biography from his childhood studying classical music, his immersion in the world of electronic music. With his then-partner Paul Beaver, Krause provided synthesizer and natural soundscapes for dozens of Hollywood films. And he returned to school in his 30s, and he now holds a PhD in bioacoustics. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the one and only Bernie Krause.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Louise, and thank you, Maureen, for inviting me. It's wonderful. Wonderful to be here. Actually, it's wonderful to be anywhere. The Great Animal Orchestra is the story, really, of how animals taught us to dance and sing. And it's one of many narratives revealed to us through the voice of the natural world, its soundscape. And I want to point out that the soundscape has this extraordinary narrative that talks about so many things and gives us so much information. For instance, this book is about music and how soundscapes inform the language of music, but it also informs biology and communication theory and natural history and ornithology and philosophy and literature. Just as easily, if I knew the fields well enough, I could have written a piece about medicine, because soundscapes heal. I have a terrible case of ADHD and dyslexia, and I want to tell you that working in the natural world and being able to record outside requires that one be very quiet and very patient for long periods of time. And even though I had a terrible case of this when I was growing up, it really kind of mitigated that over a long period of time, and I no longer suffer from those kinds of irritated ways of dealing with the world. But it also deals with physics. It also deals with religion. I could have written about religion, because the natural soundscape in places where people live more closely connected to the natural world is the source of spirituality. I could have written about that. Politics, architecture, and I'll get into all of that, some of it tonight. And the soundscape really can be told through the lens of any of these disciplines that are on the screen right now. And in this new book, like I say, I've just limited it to music. And I began, as Louise was talking about in the introduction, Sean, can we turn this mic down a little bit? I'm beginning to get some feedback a little bit. Thanks. I began as a musician, classical musician, studying violin. Until the age of 13, I actually soloed with the Detroit Symphony Orchestra when I was 13. And then the hormones kicked in and I switched to guitar. and because I don't have great vision, my world has always been informed largely through sound. And I played guitar through, I worked my way through University of Michigan because playing guitar for Motown during the 1950s, early Motown records. And the reason that I didn't study music in school was because when I applied to Juilliard and Eastman and some of the other schools that were teaching music in 1955, I was told that guitar was not a musical instrument. There you have it. It's the story of my life. After the Weavers broke up in early 1964, with Pete and Ronnie Gilbert and Freddie Hellerman, where we had introduced the song at our Carnegie Hall concert in 1963, we introduced Guantanamera, for those of you who are old enough to remember that. And after the Weavers broke up, I came to California to study electronic music at Mills College, and Pauline Oliveris was teaching there, and so was Karlheinz Stockhausen. And there, while I was there, I met a fellow from L.A. Who was doing electronic music for films, and his name was Paul Beaver. And together, we formed a musical team and introduced the first album on the theme of ecology to the world. And In a Wild Sanctuary came about really as a result. For those of you who know his work here in Hollywood, his name is Van Dyke Parks. Great. Not many people know him. That's terrific. And he said he was going to be here tonight. I don't know. Van Dyke, are you here? No. Okay. He's just flying back from Australia. But Van Dyke, when Paul and I were kind of thrashing around looking for a theme for our album, said to us, why don't you do an album on ecology? Well, I never heard the word before. This was 1968. And I was terrified of the animal world because when I grew up, our family just never had a pet of any kind. A goldfish was dangerous. When Van Dyke said that, it kind of interested me. He said, here's a book. It's called Silent Spring, and I think you ought to read that and you'll get an idea of what I'm talking about. And sure enough, we did. And Paul and I did an album called In a Wild Sanctuary based on this theme. And not only is it the first on the theme of ecology, but it's one of the earliest to experiment with natural soundscapes as a component of orchestration. So it was a very important album. And it meant that one of us, either Paul or I, had to go outside and record. And for me, that was a real challenge because I was absolutely terrified. I mean, a zoo was dangerous to me. So with a small recorder, which was just becoming available then, the small Ewer recorders, for those of you who remember that kind of technology, it was a reel-to-reel tape recorder with small reels of tape, and a pair of stereo microphones that just became available for recording outside at the time, I ventured into the dark passages of Muir Woods, just north of San Francisco, now a national park with lots of trails and signage so you know where you are and you don't get lost, and began to record at that site. And as soon as I turned on the recorder and heard the stereo imaging and that space opened up through my earphones, my life was transformed. And this was 1968 when we were preparing for this album. And I said to myself that this is something I've really got to do and look into more thoroughly. And at that moment, I made the decision that the rest of my life I was going to spend not in a studio, not in an office, not 9 to 5, but outside recording animals. And I tried to figure out a way to do that, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. But one of the first things that we did for this album was a piece called Walking Green Algae Blues. And Walking Green, we have no shame. And Walking Green Algae Blues was really a neat piece. It's just guitar and synthesizer, and guitar and Hammond organ, and Paul on the Hammond, and Howard Roberts on guitar. And I had recorded the stream in Muir Woods. And this is just a short example of that. When we finished that, by the way, that theme was picked up by a fellow by the name of Daniel Cohn Bendit. I don't know if you know who he is, but he's the fellow that started the Green Party in Germany and was very much a part of the French student revolution in 1968. And they used this theme, much to the embarrassment of my late partner, Paul. Paul died in 75. Paul was, let's just say that we were at very opposite sides of the political spectrum. And this was not something that was high on Paul's list of things to do. Well, on the screen is is the first page of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. And the reason I have it on the page here is because I want to demonstrate how sound is organized. And you can see that sound is organized on this page where time reads from left to right. Even though you're not a musician, you'll understand this really quickly. And from the lowest note down on the bottom line to the highest note on the top, from the basses to the flutes on the top line. Sometimes this piece is known as Judge Judy's theme, but we won't go there. And you can see how sound is organized in that way in its traditional musical scoring. And this is a spectrogram of the score, and a spectrogram is a graphic illustration of sound. And you want to know how we arrived at this organization of sound, we need to ask some questions first. How sound looks when we look at it as a spectrogram. Think of this again as a bar of music. These are lines, on a musical staff, and time reads from left to right. It's actually 11 bars here. But I want to show how this works and how all of these instruments find niches to be heard, because if when you're scoring, you score so that the instruments are all jumbled together, none is going to be defined with its own voice. But here, watch this. This is very cool. Flute, harp, cello. So this is how we organize sound when we're scoring it. Pay some attention to that because it's going to play an important role in what I'm going to talk about in just a few minutes. The soundscape was first identified by R. Murray Schafer, a Canadian composer and naturalist whose music, by the way, everybody ought to hear, and whose book, Tuning of the World, is one of the best books on any subject that's related to sound I've ever read. It reads like a great novel, and if you haven't read it, pick it up if you're interested in the soundscapes of the world. And he did this book, Tuning of the World, in 1977. And by soundscape, he meant all of the sound that reaches the human ear from any source. Well, I wanted to be able to define the soundscape because we have no language for sound in English and certainly in American English. Everything is kind of graphically illustrated and expressed. And so I wanted to figure out a way to describe the different sources of sound that are part of the soundscape. And the first is the geophony, geo meaning earth, and the phone coming from the Greek word for sound. And it's all the non-biological sounds that occur in a given habitat, wind in the trees or grasses, the effects of the sounds of water in a stream, waves at the ocean shore, movement of the earth. We know about that in Los Angeles. Anyway, biophony is the second of these, bio meaning life and phone again meaning sound, sounds of living organisms in a given habitat. And the third, of course, is all the sounds that we humans make, and some of it is controlled sound like music and theater. And the rest of it, most of it, is incoherent sound, which I call noise, which comes to us through all of the electromechanical devices that we seem to not be able to do without. Now, the biophony is by far the most important, and it's one of the things that I'm going to be talking about more and more tonight. And it talks about the fact that in many wild habitats, creatures vocalize in these special relationships to one another, sometimes cooperative, sometimes competitive. And it's just like instruments in an orchestra. And think about how we might have got that. And this partitioning of voices, the structure of these voices in a habitat, when we listen really closely and learn to listen, divides these critter voices into frequency bandwidth and temporal bandwidth. Sometimes one sings and it stops singing in one band, and then another will come in and fill that bandwidth. And it helps us understand our relationships to the natural world if we really get a handle on this stuff. And it's not hard to do. And it was biophony that first inspired us to dance and sing. And here's how that looks. I showed you that spectrogram of music before. Well, this is a spectrogram of a small snippet of sound that I recorded at Camp Leakey in Borneo. Camp Leakey is where Baruti galdicus does rehabilitation of orangutans, and it's a wonderful habitat to record in because, at least at this time when I recorded in the mid-90s, it was still pretty much pristine and untouched. Now, what's happening here, if you take a look at these niches, again, think of this as a bar of music, and you'll completely understand what I'm talking about. You'll see that the insects are holding like a whole note right here. The cicadas, this guy right here and here, he's playing like three notes on a piano, and he finds niches that are unoccupied that he's able to express his voice. And here's a chestnut-winged babbler right here, this guy right here in this line, and here's a Malaysian-eared nightjar right here. Notice as soon as the cicada stops singing, the nightjar comes in, then the babbler, and then the nightjar again, and then the cicada. So it's not only a temporal relationship, there's a frequency relationship, and of course, the gibbons, the mammals, are down here in the bass. And here's what this sounds like. To our ear, it's going to sound chaotic and kind of jumbled, but look how this is structured. Down here. Hey, voila. You know, what we're seeing here, you know, I talked about all those disciplines in the beginning. We're looking at proto-music. We're looking at because we mimicked this structure in our music, and people that live closely connected to that natural world do just that. We learned a little bit about biology, how creatures stay out of each other's way when they're vocalizing, when their vocal behavior demands it, if they want to be heard. We're talking about physics. We're talking about the structure of sound. We're talking about natural history, because this is an older habitat, and only older habitats that are still viable have this kind of structure and discrimination between all the sounds. Well, the soundscapes reveal a lot of information. Here's an expression of resource management. This in 1988. We were told by a lumber company in the Sierra Nevada Mountains, a 3.5-hour drive east of San Francisco, that selective logging was going to have no impact on the habitat. And we said, fine, we'll try that. It was a relatively new a model for resource extraction. But I said, I want to record before you do it, and we got permission to do that, and I want to record after we got permission to do that. Well, here's the sound of Lincoln Meadow, and this is the picture. I want you to kind of keep this in mind of what Lincoln Meadow looked like. You'll notice the bottom quarter of the page is represented by a stream that ran through the meadow, right, coursed right through the middle of it, and the top three quarters are all birds, several different species. And here's that soundscape, just a short snippet. Okay, selective logging took place that summer in 1988, and we went back a year later to record, and this is what the soundscape looks like now. The stream is still rolling through the habitat, but take a look at this picture. It looks pretty much the same. To our eye and to the camera, there's no change, and that's what they meant. But to the ear, check this out. That's a Williamson sapsucker, a kind of woodpecker. And to our eye, this place really looks undisturbed, but the soundscape tells a very different story. And as Louise said from my book, you know, while a picture may be worth 1,000 words, a soundscape is worth 1,000 pictures. It doesn't lie. Aldo Leopold, the wonderful ecologist who wrote in the 1940s, once said, if we're going to tamper with nature, we better keep all the parts. This is a, here's another version of what a soundscape can tell us. This is a coral reef. The bottom half of the page in this spectrogram is all surface noise of waves at the surface, and the top is represented, heard actually by static, is represented by 11 different species of fish around this coral reef in Fiji. And here's what it sounds like. And about 400 yards to the south, the coral reef, the same reef, is dying as a result of ocean acidification due to high carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere, and also pollution and human noise. And take a look at this again. Notice the top half filled with fish. And here's the coral reef 400 meters away that's dying. Soundscape immediately tells you what's going on. And here it is. These are again, the waves at the surface. Those few snaps are snapping shrimp. And here's an example of the impact of human noise. I don't know how many of you have been to Mono Lake, just to the east of Yosemite National Park, but it's an extraordinarily beautiful place. It's magical. And what happens is these little spadefoot toads, they're named spadefoots because they have these clawed front feet, and they dig themselves about a yard under the surface, the hard-pan surface of the desert soil. They can dig themselves down there and stay in these carapaces for years at a time without coming out until conditions are just absolutely right. And when the conditions are right, when there's enough humidity in the soil, they dig their ways to the surface, and in just a few short weeks, they gather around these vernal pools in large numbers to vocalize for two reasons. Again, we were talking about competitive and cooperative relationships. Well, the competitive one is because they want to find mates, and the cooperative one is because if they all vocalize in a chorus, a synchronous chorus together, no predator like owls or coyotes or foxes can draw a bead on any one and pick out an individual. And here's what they sound like when they're chorusing together. You can see there are no breaks in the chorusing here. But just about 90 seconds later, this is a habitat also favored by Navy jet pilots who were training. And what they do is they fly their jets at 650 miles an hour, about 300 feet above ground level, right over the Mono Basin. And they set their computers so their planes will fly right over the hills. And what happens is when the planes fly by, this plane was 3.5 miles away from us. Take a look at the energy of the Frog Chorus here. And this is the Frog Chorus. This is the jet plane down here. Watch how the energy drops. And notice how the breaks in the chorusing occur. And this is what it sounds like. It's just 90 seconds later. It took 45 minutes for the frogs to get their chorusing back in sync again, during which time it was a full moon and we saw a couple of coyotes and a great horned owl come in and pick off a few frogs. And the frog populations were beginning to drop seriously in the Mono Basin, but they've since come back, and the toads are pretty much back to normal now since the Navy overflights have dropped off. There's a lot of resistance in environmental sciences to anthropomorphism, and certainly I can understand why it's very easy to attach certain emotions that we have and feelings that we have to the lives of other animals. But, you know, it's the old Cartesian trope. The question is, do animals have these feelings or emotions? Emotional expression, happiness or sadness, is very much a part of music. And I, for one, think we actually got this from the natural world. And I keep asking the question, what inspired us to formulate sound in that way and express it through our music? Well, a colleague of mine answered that question. His name is Kurt Olson. He records in the Midwest, American Midwest, around Minnesota. And he had been recording there for many years around this very pristine lake where there was no farmland and no human development. And he was recording there three springs ago when a couple of fish and wildlife guys came on the scene suddenly for no reason, dropped a couple of sticks of dynamite down the beaver dam that formed this pond. It was a wonderful ecosystem. And it destroyed the female and the pups that had been born. Well, he sat there astonished and tried to gather his thoughts and decided to record the rest of the day. And he picked up one of the most unusual sounds I've ever heard. It's a sad story, but it's a story that I've got to play for you because it conveys this better than anything I know. As a matter of fact, it's the saddest sound I've ever heard. The male beaver, wounded, swimming in slow circles in the evening, crying out inconsolably for its mate and lost offspring. Lauren Isley, the great ecologist from the University of Pennsylvania, once wrote, he said, "I've never entered a wood, but what I hear footsteps in the leaves tiptoeing away." The geophony has maybe inspired animal sounds, because geophony, after all, was the first sound that we ever heard on the planet, because life formed in water. And as we learn to, organisms learn to express themselves in these environments, they had to find niches where their voices could be heard. So they learned to do that first. And then the geophony, I think, inspired biophony. And here's an example of a link between thunderstorms that occur at the equator, get this, and the voices of seals that are different species of seals, one at the North Pole and one at the South Pole in the Antarctic. Well, When thunderstorms occur at the equator, and they do several thousand of them every hour, they generate electrical energy that's transmitted through the magnetic fields of the Earth to both poles. And this is what they sound like. This is what the electrical energy of the thunderstorm sounds like when picked up with low-frequency radio receivers, NASA receivers, in the Antarctic, but also in the Arctic. Here's what they sound like. These are thunderstorms, electrical energy of them now. And they're called whistlers. Now, this is a Weddell seal. It lives in the Antarctic. And listen to its vocalization. Doesn't sound biological, does it? And here's a bearded seal 10,000 miles away in the Arctic. Find that stuff amazing. And what's happening is, what we think is happening, is that kind of like some humans have suggested, those that have that silver amalgam in their mouths from the dentist, they've received radio signals. It's kind of like those little I forgot those little radio things that we called crystal radios when we were kids. You put a little wire on it, and you heard radio signals. Well, there's a lot of magnetite in these guys' heads, and what we think is happening is they're actually picking up those signals and imitating them as part of their voices. We don't know that, but we think that that might be the case. And this is an example of the a recording that was made by a colleague and friend of mine, Louis Sarno, who's an American from New Jersey who went to the Central African Republic and the Zonga-Songa rainforest in the southwestern part of the country, in the middle of Africa, in a very remote and almost inaccessible place. And he's been living with the Bayaka pygmies since 1984 and recording them. The reason he records them and wanted to hear their sounds is because he was captivated by the music that he heard on an NPR program in the 80s. And he wanted to find out what that was all about. And what he discovered was that these folks are kind of inspired into song by the soundscapes of the forest around them. In other words, they use the forest as kind of a karaoke orchestra with which they perform. No kidding. When the sounds are certain sounds at dawn, they sing certain kinds of songs. When the sounds are midday sounds, they sing certain kinds of songs and dance to them. And the same thing at night. Now, this is an example. You can see the spectrogram defined up here. And there's this frog, which we won't be able to hear at this point, but this flute player who's playing the flute down here is playing to the rhythm of the frog. And this is an example of how music is connected to the natural world and how, in fact, we got our music. Here it is. Okay. Now you can see how kind of it all comes together. But we also learned to dance with the deer and the buffalo and the bear. And, you know, for me, when I began this work, the model for recording in the natural world was limited to a fragmented capture of individual species songs and calls, mostly birds taken out of context, and more recently, frogs and mammals. But people were going around with these big parabolic dishes and capturing these sounds, and that's what most of the collections are all about. But you know, to me, it was like trying to understand Beethoven's Fifth Symphony by abstracting the voice of a single violin player out of the orchestra and listening to that one part. That's what we've been doing. And that result has shown up in our music. For instance, we've taken just certain aspects, we've singled them out because of the way that science is organized. We've singled them out of context and tried to express them in different ways. And what I would ask you to do here is try to imagine yourself as a 15-year-old, not terribly musically literate, and try to imagine in your own mind what, even if you know the piece, forget it for a second, and think what these sounds, whether or not these sounds represent anything about the natural world. Okay, now remember, you're a 15-year-old who doesn't know too much about music. Here is another one. Same question. Okay. Messiaen, the French composer, the mid-20th century composer, was a wonderful ornithologist. And he and his wife, Yvonne, would go off into the French woods and try to notate the sounds of birds that he heard singing in the woods. What was interesting about what he did, and he comes a little bit closer to this kind of realization that I'm thinking about, like the Bayaka. But what he did was, what most of us have done, is he notated only the birds that fit the musical paradigms of the French Music Academy. So all the other birds were eliminated. They were gone. Of the 10,000 birds, approximately, 10,000 bird species that exist in the world, only 100 have been used in Western music. Now here's an example of Messiaen's music. This is called Chronochromy. It's from a wonderful orchestral piece. Of the 100 birds that have been used in music, in Western music, Messiaen probably represents a third of those. He's actually used them and figured out a way to make that work. The next two examples I'm going to play for you are, I'll tell you that they are a mammal. If you know the pieces, please don't shout them out. What I'd like you to think about is what mammal these two Americans are writing about. First, Alan Hovhaness. Okay, now this is the same mammal by George Crumb. Okay, we're thinking mammals now. Anybody want to take a guess? Shout it out. What?
Elephant.
Badger. I hear a whale. It is a whale. They're writing about humpback whales. All right. Anyway, we're talking about the birds that sound musical. And here's an example of a bird that sounds musical. I mean, any musician in the audience can figure out that this guy is fairly bluesy. It's a common potu, and a common potu covers the ground anywhere from Mesoamerica to the Amazon basin. And it sings this wonderful jazzy bluesy thing that it keeps repeating all the time. And here's a common potu. I rest my case. Here's a musician wren. Same area, covers the same area. And the musician wren sings these lovely passages, really tonal and musical. And then he gets to a point where a parrot interrupts him. And mid-phrase, he lets the parrot do his thing. Again, we're talking about temporal niches. Lets the parrot do his thing. Parrot finishes. He picks up the phrase right where the parrot left off. Watch this. Here comes a parrot. Watch. Okay, musician wren. Now, these guys don't appear anywhere in our music yet, but they're there and they're ready to be exploited. 102 birds. There's this French eco-philosopher by the name of Luc Ferry. I don't know how many of you have read him, but he wrote a book called in the early 90s called The New Ecological Order. And these two voices remind me that of Luc Ferry's phrase, "Nature is beautiful when it imitates art." Now, tell me why this isn't musical. When my wife and I were in Ecuador last time, and we were in the Amazon part of the Ecuador, on the other side of the Andes, the eastern side of the Andes, we came across this fig tree that was hollowed out in the forest. And I dropped a couple of little lavalier microphones down in the hollow of that fig tree, and down in the bottom were these tiny baby vultures, yellow-headed baby vultures. And I wanted to see if I could capture their sound. Listen to this. These are babies. You don't put your hand down there. They could fit in your hand. But my question is, why aren't those musical to our ear? And why don't you hear sounds like that? Like, why aren't hippopotami part of our musical lexicon or other critters? They're just left out in the cold, and they're lonely, and they need help. Anyway, I'll bet you didn't know sea anemones make noise. Well, come on now. We were in Alaska, and I came across this tide pool in Alaska and saw these gorgeous anemones. They're in all colors. They're yellows and blues and greens and reds, and because they like the cool water of the tidal zones there. And I decided to drop a hydrophone down the mouth part, the soft part of this anemone, and got some unusual sounds because the tentacles of the anemone were grasping the hydrophone to see if there was anything of nutritional value. Yeah, well, wait till you hear what it said. An anemone. Here are the tentacles looking, you know, for food. The hydrophone is an underwater mic covered with neoprene. And when it didn't find anything, it expelled the hydrophone. Yeah. We were told by some politicians from Alaska who will remain nameless, and you can probably guess who they are, that there was nothing living in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. I'm trying to be serious. And Don Young, oh, I said I wasn't going to mention his name, among others, held up this big white poster board in Congress and said, you know, there's nothing here, and that's why we have to dig the place up for oil and other things. Well, nobody had ever decided to record there. I mean, nobody had done any recording of any of the wildlife up there. So in 2006, I took three teams, one to the Beaufort Sea, which is right here near the Canadian border, by the way, right on the edge of the sea, one upslope near the Brooks Range, which runs right across here at an angle, and upslope about 70 miles toward the Brooks Range, called the North Slope for that reason. And I was on the southern end of the Brooks Range in the tundra, and also part of the boreal forest that goes all the way from the Canadian Maritimes all the way to Alaska. And you can still see trees there. And we recorded these soundscapes that are the first baseline recordings in history of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And we had wonderful support from Lucasfilm and Harvard, Google, Stanford, University of Utah, SanDisk, and many other groups. This is a recording made at Timber Lake, which was the southernmost part, and it's the western part of the boreal forest. These are tree and white-crowned sparrows, red poles, brown squirrels. Sorry. Not much there. And this is Sunset Pass. This is the North Slope area. Again, blue throats, snits, longspur, red poles, and sparrows. It's a wonderful place, and it's a place with no roads and no signage and no people telling you where you need to go. You can't buy anything there. And this is Beaufort Lagoon, which is right on the farthest northern coast. You can see the Brooks Range right here, 70 miles to the south. Well, people are always asking me what we can do to try to make it a better place and certainly a quieter place. And I'd like to encourage everyone that I talk with to try to get to places where there's little or no human noise and where you can be attentively quiet and really listen. And these sounds are very subtle, but they're reaching out to us, clearly expressing the need to thrive. And we've got the keys to all the life support systems. And they're canaries in the mine that we might want to keep, we might very much want to keep singing, because they give us a lot of information about how we're doing in relationship to the natural world. And before I close tonight, you've been such a great audience, I'm going to play something that we did about 20 years ago or so. It's an album that I did with all animal sounds. It's called Gorillas in the Mix. I'm still trying to be serious here. We had tunes like Stomp in the Name of Love and Ape No Mountain High Enough. The album was done entirely with animal sounds, no synthesizer, no traditional instruments. All the percussion that you're going to hear in this little snippet were done with fish, drum fish, really played kick drum. The steel drums sound that you're going to hear is a real elephant sound recorded in Africa, and so on. And I'll try to call them out as you hear them. The first bass sound that you hear is actually a walrus. This is called Trout from Ipanema. Fish. You can get Gorillas in the Mix on iTunes, by the way, if you feel you want to be tortured more. Okay, I'd like to open it up for questions now, and we'll take some questions from the audience.
Hi, I'm from Vancouver, Canada. I had heard the documentary about your work on the CBC.
Yes.
And the cry of that beaver, literally when that program ended, I was in tears. But I also would like you to mention about the recovery of Chernobyl, the sound of Chernobyl, where after it's been completely decimated, that the animals actually, the sound returned, didn't it?
Yes. I have what this nice person is talking about is that the Chernobyl disaster occurred in 1988, and for 3 years there was no sound at all. And a colleague of mine from the UK, a fellow by the name of Peter Kuzak, went there in 2006 to record. And he found that the soundscape had almost completely returned. There were bears and wolves and all kinds of critters that hadn't been seen or heard there before. Certainly humans can't go back there and live, but birds don't know barriers, and so they're able to repopulate that whole area. And it's one of the most unusual recovery events that's occurred in the natural world, particularly from the perspective of the soundscape. I don't have a recording of that here on this, although I could close it up and play it for you if you'd like to hear it. I'm not going to do that right now. But anyway, but you can hear it. You can hear it on our website, which is wildsanctuary.com, and you hear it there, and it's certainly in the book. And if you get the book, the book will lead you to a website that has all of these sounds listed. That's a teaser. It's worth it.
Yeah.
Yes.
The seals and the storms reminded me. Do migrating birds, when they pick up, apparently they're guided, like a GPS, by electrical waves from the earth. When they migrate, does their sound change as a result of them picking up different kinds of sounds from
the earth?
That's
a really great question. What we noticed was when we could still get into Venezuela, we were working in the jungles there in the northern part of Venezuela. And what we noticed is the migrating birds, the birds that come through the eastern flyways, they all try to find locations where the soundscape, where the niches, will allow their voices to be heard. So they fly over these grids of sound in the jungle until they find a place where the soundscape is going to be supportive for them. And it's remarkable to watch these flocks of birds looking for these places that are now being cut down at a huge, rapid rate. And so a lot of the warblers in the east are beginning to lose population as a result of that, because they can't find places where their voices can't be heard, and where their voices are masked, they don't survive. Yes?
Didn't Ren Kleiss use some of your sounds for Where the Wild Things Are?
He did that, dog.
But could you talk a little bit about your work in cinema and how you've worked with sound recordists and mixers in different films?
Yes. I worked mostly with synthesizer in films when Paul was alive. And we did about 135 feature films. After Paul died, I worked on Apocalypse Now and several other films, doing a lot of the helicopter sounds and music. And I've worked on a number of films since, just providing soundscapes like Shipping News, Castaway, a film by Carol Ballard called Duma about I don't know if any of you saw that, about a wonderful cheetah. And I did a lot of those sounds. And I worked with Ren on the Where the Wild Things Are. I did some of them, not a whole lot, but some.
My question is about empathy, and I'm wondering if you believe, you know, with the imitations of sounds, do you believe there's any evidence to suggest that these different creatures are exhibiting empathy?
There are a couple of books that have been written by scientists like Ken Norris about empathy and helping other creatures and being involved with other creatures. I don't know if any of you saw that YouTube thing recently about the goat and the pig, saving the pig. There's a big thing about that on the news. But there are animals that display that. Certainly dolphins have done that. But I've seen that with mountain gorillas, and I've seen that with the beaver thing, expressing, you know, a loss in a family. Certainly with the mountain gorillas, I worked in Diane Fossey's camp and spent a month there working with the mountain gorillas, and was able to get close enough to them where I could actually nest down with them during the day. And there was one female that lost a baby, and she carried this infant, the dead infant, around with her for days, you know, just caring for that thing and whimpering over it. And people, the gorillas would come over, the males and the females would all come over and provide some solace for this individual who had lost her baby. I've seen it happen with elephants, where elephants will take care of their young and take care of each other even when and nurse try to nurse them back when they're sick. So I've seen that a lot. I've seen it expressed in many instances.
So I guess we're not alone with emotions in the animal kingdom.
Nor are we the first.
Oh. Speaking of composers, how many birds has Gustav Mahler put into his compositions?
I honestly don't know the answer to that. I don't really know. What I know is that when I did a count of all the birds that have been included in Western music, of the 10,000, it came to like around 100. So I don't know who did what, but I do know that Messiaen has probably used more birds than any other composer so far.
Okay, can I ask, have you ever recorded bees and downsampled from their frequency?
Oh, yes.
Tell us about that.
Well, bees are really, I was recording Africanized bees in Africa where I just pinned a couple. I walked up to a tree and the person I was with really understood that the bees weren't going to swarm. You get crazy when you do this stuff, I tell you. And I tacked a couple of little lavalier microphones to the leaves of the tree and got these bees, just buzzing around and doing their thing. And so, yes, I have recorded them, it's kind of fun to have that in your archive. Yes?
This is really fascinating and also somewhat depressing, some of what you're, you know, the impact of humans on the creatures that you're recording. So I'm wondering if you've felt like it's had an impact on people changing the damage that they're doing in some situations.
Well, Richard Louv wrote a book called Last Child in the Woods, which I'd also recommend you getting it. He talks about nature deficit disorder. And we all suffer from it because the further we draw away from the natural world, the more pathological we become as a culture. And he points out the ways in which that happens, particularly with young kids these days. And one of the... I've lost the track of your question.
Has anyone listened to you?
The question is, has anybody listened to me and stopped? I haven't a clue. You know, there comes a certain point in your life where you just do what you do and you hope that somebody is going to get the message. And typically when I'm talking to younger audiences, they get the message because, you know, they're looking for paths in their lives that they can follow. And a lot of people my age have really reached the point where they're kind of at the end of their path and their end of their energies. But the kids are really looking for something to do, and they want something to do that's useful. What I do when I go in and I do these outreach programs in classrooms, and when I do that, I ask the kids, I give them an exercise. I give them one of these small recorders, which are really wonderful these days. You can get great recorders for under $200 that 15 or 20 years ago would have cost $20,000. So you can get these things. They fit in your pocket. They're tiny and they're great. Well, I tell kids to go out and record a robin. Just record the sound of a robin. They're everywhere. They're in your backyard. And they go out and they bring these recordings. They're all excited, and they bring these recordings back to me, and I listen to them, and I say, yeah, but there's a truck, and there's a motorcycle. I said, I just want a robin. Just go and get me a robin. And they go back out again, and they try again, and they bring it back, and they're all excited. And they said, well, there was a robin in the tree, and I got him. Okay, I said, yeah, there's a plane flying over, and there's a helicopter. And they said, but there's a lot of noise out there. Yeah. So what should we do about that? And I leave it up to them to answer that question. You frame the question for them, you frame the problem for them, and let them solve it. It's really important to get people involved at that level. Two more. Who's it going to be?
Hi. I just want to say thank you so much for being here. Am I talking loud enough?
Thank you.
This question is also along the lines of the ability of sound to emote. I'm wondering if you have particular sounds that inspire joy in you, beauty, and like ugly, like the ugliest sound, the prettiest sound, and the most joyful sound to you.
It's kind of like the question that this.
I know superlatives are stupid, but
no. It's a great question. I'll answer that in a second. It's one of the questions I get when I talk to kids a lot is, "What's the most dangerous animal you ever recorded?" And I don't miss a beat. I say man. And then this one kid said to me, "But my father says that a polar bear is the most dangerous animal you could record." I said, "Have you ever seen a polar bear with an AK-47? Anyway, it really boils down to us, yeah, and the noise we make. The most joyous sound I've ever heard is any sound from a natural habitat that doesn't have an airplane flying through it, or a straight-piping motorcycle, or somebody trying to assert their presence through noise, which is what we do as a culture. I mean, everywhere we go into a restaurant, we've got that damn music blaring everywhere. I can't stand that. I don't know why they do that, but it's part of the impulse to turn over quickly the patrons who come into these restaurants. That's why they're so noisy. They want you the hell out of there. They want to make more money, and that's why they do it. I just go away. I just can't go in there. Anybody else? One more question. Yes.
Howdy. I'm glad I'm last, because this is going to take a second to ask. But I've read in a book, I think it was Evolution's Rainbow.
Yes.
About how in large lakes in Africa, there had been quite a lot of diversity in these kind of fish called cichlids.
Yes.
And that was all based on selective breeding, either based on color, pattern, or behavior. And that as there's been more and more motorboat activity, it's kind of churned up the water, and so the fish will kind of just mate with whatever fish they can bump up against. And so all these like weird diversities within a single species have kind of gone back and like mixed back just like into like one muddy brown color.
Yes.
And I was wondering if you'd seen like a similar thing happen to diversity within a single species based on like selective breeding of mating calls and then too much noise pollution.
That's a really great question, and I can only answer it this way. The idea of soundscape ecology, which is the field that I'm involved in, is really new. The whole idea of recording these things in a holistic way began with the work that I started in 1968, and when I got my PhD in 1981, there were only six people with a PhD in bioacoustics. Now there are like 700 or 800. And so it's a relatively new field, and people really haven't gotten down to the nitty-gritty of how to record these things and what all the meaning is in it. And so the shifts in population density, the ways in which species are evolving. It's really too short of a period of time to really see the changes from this perspective. And we're looking for that, and hopefully we're going to find that with the new programs that are in effect now. There's a program in soundscape ecology at Purdue University. I'm on the graduate faculty there. And there's also a program at Michigan State in the Envirosonics Department. And those are the leading schools in this field right now, and the only schools in the country. Hopefully more and more are going to come online. I thank you. You've been a great audience, and I thank you for coming. Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.